To Radical Simple Living Podcast. This is season 2, episode 22. And I'm talking to you today from my, as normal as it happens, from my kitchen in my homestead here in southern Sweden. We are in full spring now. It's taken a long time this year. It's been a slow spring to come, but as a eager grower they always seem, They come too slowly for me. But it's here all of a sudden, and the frosty nights seem to have gone. And things that happen, I've lived in UK and Sweden, and I've been growing things in UK and Sweden, nowhere else. But I can tell you, in UK, springtime is a slow thing. It happens every day. There's a new little bud out, or there's a new flower, then you know crocus or snowdrops or daffodils coming up, and then eventually bluebells, and this all happens over a period of weeks, and trees come into leaf slowly. In Sweden it also happens at once, and everything comes into leaf and everything comes into flower. It seems very, very quickly over a 2-week period. It's a very fast spring, and you have to be ready for it, and getting ready for it is quite a thing. There's lots of seeds to sow, there's lots of planting to do, there's lots of all kinds of things to organise, and all of a sudden you find yourself rushed off your feet with doing these things. I'm not complaining, it's good, but it does come at a bit of a shock to the system sometimes. It has been warm. We've been up to beyond 20 Celsius in a couple of afternoons, and that's good enough for me. So a few things indoors to go out still, but they're hardening off. The fire I'm now only lighting in the evenings if it's cold. So there's no crackling fire here today because it's not that cold yet. But I still need to light it. This morning when I got up, it was still below 3. So it's still quite cold at night. Now, what I want to talk about today is a bit expansive. Because you could argue that most of the time on these podcasts, I'm talking about what you do and your train of thought and your way forward and your way of doing things. And I try, although I may not always succeed, not to give people direct advice on what to do, because people are in so many different situations, but to sow the seeds of things you might consider thinking about. So I really give hints on growing or cooking or doing anything, because you do it your own way, but I'm saying you could be thinking about doing this, you could be thinking about doing this. Maybe that's me fooling myself that I'm not giving you advice when I really am, but I don't know. But today I want to broaden that into thinking what effect you have on the rest of the world by trying to live more simply. First of all, do you have any effect on those living around you? And the second thought is, does it really matter to you if you have an effect on those living around you or not? And that's quite a difficult thing to work out, because choosing a simple life does involve a degree of being different and a degree of going in a different direction than the rest of the world seems to be going at. But are you expecting people to follow you? Are you expecting people to do the same thing? Do you assume that when people see what you're doing, they'll say, that's not a bad idea, I could do that? Well, I think people do. I think people do exactly that. I think they do look at what you're doing and follow you. They may not follow you in every aspect of your life, but they may think about something. They may see your garden full of vegetables at the right time of year and open flowers for pollinators. And they may go away and think, well, you know, I could do a bit more about growing something in my garden. So you have a bit of an effect that way. Or they might take what you're doing and see you, you know, preparing food and harvesting berries to make all sorts of things from, and decide to give that a try themselves. Who knows? People will imitate you if they think what you're doing is good. They will imitate you if they think what you're doing is saving money. Or they'll follow you if they can see that you're enjoying what you're doing and you're getting fun out of it, or people are stopping to look at what you're doing in your garden and not stopping to look what they're doing in their garden because they've got it decked over or covered in astroturf or some terrible thing like that. So you can have an influence within your community. Now, that brings us to the bigger idea of, if you're going to be looked at by people in your community, and maybe you're going to influence to some extent people in your community, it's a two-way thing. Maybe they're going to influence you at all. I get an awful lot of ideas about just wandering around and seeing what other people have been doing. And it makes you think who that community is. Now, I wanted to give you a quote here from Jill Winger. Jill Winger of that wonderful podcast called Old Fashioned on Purpose. And she says an awful lot, and she has a good habit of summing up things very nicely. But annoyingly, I cannot find the direct quote from her that was a few weeks ago. But I can give you the gist of it. It's Jill Winger just quote in that sense. It's not an actual quote. She said, don't spend a lot of time looking for a community of like-minded people that are going to grow, that are going to agree with you on all sorts of things. Instead of that, look at the real people in the community where you live and do your best to get on with them. And I think that's an incredibly perceptive way to look at it, to be honest. Try and get on with people, even if you may have political or religious or lifestyle differences from them. They are the people that live near you. And you don't have to be on top of them. You don't have to be popping into their houses. But you can just be nice and polite and be helpful to them when you can. So with this community, what are we doing? Well, we're trying to see if ideas spread, if ripples go out from the stone you drop in the pond. And I can tell you they do, but it might be on a very small scale and it might take a long time. You are, of course, a member of other communities. You're a member of online communities. You're, you know, maybe on Twitter, which I refuse to call X, but there we go, or Facebook, or Mastodon, or Threads. I'm on Threads. I'm not entirely sure anything ever happens on Threads, but I am there. So if things happen, you come along and poke me on there and see if we can get some things happening. But I found it a very sleepy place to be honest. But you do have a wider community there, and there it may be people will want to know what you're doing and will show an interest and will want to emulate you in some way, not copy you, but be influenced by you. And that's good. But one of the things that online communities are very dispersed. You might find somebody that absolutely agrees with you on all the important things. And you may live in Paris and they may live in San Francisco or Vladivostok or Cape Town. So you can quite easily get a community of people around you who agree with you and share ideas with you and have the same objectives as you. But there may be great geographical differences that stop that really gelling as an absolute community. You can't give a few cuttings of something to somebody that lives in Cape Town if you live in Paris. It just can't be done. So that's a different kind of community, and that's a community for propagating ideas rather than a community that you can actually use to share real things. But we also live in bigger communities still. We live in neighbourhoods. We live in villages, or we live in towns, or we live in cities. And the people surrounding us are part of our community too. We also belong to some kind of administrative level, don't we? We have counties or states or communes, all these things which are also part of a community we live in. And how can you influence them? Well, I would suggest by getting them to try and look at the same things you're doing. For instance, you may think it's a great idea to grow as much of your own food as you can. But does the nation you live in try and grow as much food as it can? I lived for many years in UK. I was born in the UK. I was born in London. And Britain over the years has had a very poor record of doing as much as it can with agricultural land. For the first thing, you know, people that produce food are undervalued and underrated and are treated as another industry. Oh, agriculture, it's another industry. It's a pretty important one, I would say. I've spoken about this in the past, but I do think agriculture is more important than plastic pole making, for instance, or magazine publishing. I just think food production is important. Now, given that, farmers haven't had a lot of help. Farmers have been told years over years, they've been given directives from government to specialise when they should have been diversifying. Very small family run farms that grow all sorts of things and keep a few animals and are broadly self-sufficient but might have a bit of surplus to sell off are not favoured in some countries. They are in others, but in many countries these kind of people are seen as irritants. You know, you want to run a small farm and sell a few things at the farm gate. A lot of places make it very difficult for people to work in that way and for people to make some additional income in that way. It's frowned upon. And there are also countries which tend to push farmers in one direction. In Britain, a big push was to get farmers into dairy farming. And there's nothing wrong with dairy farming, but it's not the only farming there is. We also need food crops. We also need fruits and roots and cereals and all the kinds of things like that. And you can only get those by the kind of mixed farming that governments have deliberately tried to steer people away from. Now, the other thing you want to do as a self-sufficient person is to make things. You want to make whatever you can. In my case, making things is very rough carpentry. I'm a hammer and nails man. I can do things with a hammer and nails. When it comes to, you know, cutting special joints and joinery and fine carpentry, I'm not that skilled. But I can knock things together. I can cook. I consider myself to be an experienced and good cook, and I can take raw ingredients and turn them into a meal. I hope everybody can do that, but some people can't. I've met people who claim not to be able to cook anything. Some people are incredibly skilled at dressmaking and knitting and getting things together and taking yarn or fabric or fibres and turning them into something special. That too is wonderful. And we shouldn't forget people that are able to take a canvas and some paint or a block of clay or really anything and turn it into a work of art, because I do believe producing art is just as important as producing other things. And that's something a lot of us can do. We can turn our hands to art and we can work at it. And if nobody else likes it, we can still get an awful lot of enjoyment about it. But does the country you live in, does the state that you live in, hold these things as important as they should be? Does it hold food production to be important? Does it hold manufacturing things on small scales to be important? Does it consider art to be important? Does it consider skilled artisans working away to be important? And you can judge this in all kinds of ways. But if a country gives up on producing things and gives up on growing things and gives up on making things, then we're in a bit of a spot, aren't we? Now, those of you who use an online supplier like Amazon, there's a little exercise that I want you to do at some point. You don't have to do it now, but give it a shot next time you're in front of your laptop and you've got nothing better to do. Go to your Amazon list of past orders and go through the past 20 items on it. So the past 20 items on your order from Amazon or whatever online supplier you use. Now, you don't have to tell me what you've been ordering. I don't want to know that. Although those places do odd things like other people also ordered this. So you you go on Amazon to order a dog leash, and it says other people also order, then it gives you a sack of diapers or something. You think, well, there's no connection here, is there? Or you go on to order a pair of size 48 boots, and it says other people also ordered, and then it will give you a goldfish tank or something like that. So it's weird. I don't know why they do that. So, oh, you know, I might order a goldfish tank too now. It's crazy. Go to your last 20 items and look and try and see where they were made. Now, it might need you, you might know that because you've got the goods in your house and you can have a look at them and see where they were made. Or it may be you have to go back and look at the description and see where it was made. How many of those things, those last 20 items, were made in the country you actually live in? Well, it depends, of course, doesn't it? If you live in a big country, if you live in America or Australia or Canada or Russia, those are big countries, they can produce a lot of things. If you live in Liechtenstein or Luxembourg, maybe they can't. And if you live in a country with geographical challenges, I live in Sweden, and the geographical challenge we face is that we're so far north that not a lot of things will grow here. So we have to import things. People in Iceland do, people in Alaska do. It's one of those things. If you're in Alaska and you want to eat bananas, you've got to import them. So I understand that. But a lot of the things that are manufactured are not made in your country. A lot of the things that you order will be made in China. Or they'll be made in India, maybe. If you're listening from India or China, then obviously it's okay to get things made in your own country. If you live on the other side of the world, it creates a bit of a problem, doesn't it? And this is the problem. The reason we have to import so much from other countries, like China, is because we don't make those things anymore. Now, I actively try to order things that are... I live in Sweden, which is part of the EU. I try and get things that are made in the EU. I always try very, very hard to do that. So if I want to buy a new microphone, for instance, to record these podcasts on, I will search heavily for one that's made in the European Union. Because I live in the European Union, the microphone's made in the European Union. That means, A, it hasn't got far to travel, so I'm not damaging the planet by lots of transportation fees. And B, it's part of the sort of way we have of, you know, people that work in your country, get jobs in your country and produce things. If you're living in Chicago, in the middle of the US, it's not quite in the middle, I know, but it's in the middle of it thematically, isn't it? Because it's the gateway between the, you know, the gates of the West is what they call it. If you're living in Chicago, you will want to buy things made in the States, won't you? You won't want to get a new screwdriver made in Germany. You won't want to buy a new electric fan for your office that is built in China. You will try, I hope, to buy things that are built where you live, or things that are grown where you live, or things that are put together where you live. Now, again, it's impossible to do always, because sometimes things stop being made. I don't think there's anywhere in Europe that makes flat-screen televisions. I may be wrong, but a few years ago, it's impossible if you want to buy a flat-screen television. I don't, as it happens. I don't have one and I don't want one. But if you did, you would be incredibly challenged to find that being produced in Europe. You would have to go and order it from the Far East, from China, Taiwan, Japan maybe, South Korea, somewhere like that. Now, it's no disrespect to those countries to say you would sooner buy something closer to you. Because if you're trying to be a self-sufficient person, if you're trying to build things yourself, if you're trying to grow food yourself, if you're trying to cook food yourself, you will want your country to be as self-sufficient as possible. You'll want your country to be trying hard to make what it needs and grow what it needs and generally produce what it needs. And we've got away from this idea. When I was in Britain, it was quite obvious that manufacturing industry had been in decline for about a century. I think there's this terrible point in history where before World War One, I think at the turn of the century, 99% of all steel produced in the world was produced in Great Britain, because Great Britain had the iron ore, Great Britain had the coal, and Great Britain had the technology to make as much steel. And because it was an island, it could ship that steel out to the world. So you could go to the Trans-Siberian Railway and find that British steel was being used. And you could also go across the globe to San Francisco and see British steel was being used there. Nearly all steel used in the world at the turn of the 19th to 20th century was produced in the UK. Now it is less than 0.1%, I believe, of steel used in the world is produced in the UK. Now, why has that happened? It's because Britain found an easier way of making money than manufacturing. And what they discovered is if you buy things from somewhere else in the world, you can sell them for the same price that something would be made in Britain, and you can make lots more money out of it. It's the same way that somebody someone in Minnesota can go into a store and buy something that was made in China cheaper than something that was built in the US. And the reason they can do that is because labour is cheaper in China and people can import it. So who's making all the money? Well, the people that sell it, the people that are selling it. In Britain, the entire economy, almost, with one exception, that's insurance that we send to sell to the rest of the world, the entire economy runs on buying things cheaply abroad and then selling them at a big markup in Britain. And so the major industry in Britain is now shopping. The main thing that people do in Britain is shopping, and the way people make most of their money is by selling things one way or another. And so when you reach that point, you think, well, Britain is no longer self-sufficient in making things. It's self-sufficient in buying things in and reselling them. And that's great until something goes wrong. That's great until a spanner flies in the work. That's great until we have a problem with China that involves China saying, we're not going to sell you any more of our goods. Or it involves Britain saying, we're not going to buy any more of your goods. And when that happens, what do we do? And you realise there's nothing you can do. You can't start a manufacturing industry up if you spent a century running it down. You can't suddenly open a factory making lithium batteries without enormous capital investment. And we're not going to do that as long as we can buy them from somewhere else on Earth. And this is a major worry, because by not being self-sufficient, nations are making themselves vulnerable. And the more vulnerable we are, the harder things are going to be when times get tough. We know in Europe that when Russia invaded the Ukraine, all of a sudden sanctions on Russia, because of that event, vast increases in energy, huge energy inflation, eye-wateringly high electricity bills and gas bills came to people in Europe, because they got so used to buying energy, cheap energy from Russia, that they had not bothered investing in ways to produce it themselves. And now you have people scrabbling around saying, oh, we're going to build our own power stations here, and we're going to build it. And of course, it's all too late, because we're in a position of needing things at the same time as not having the plant to produce them. Now, I'm glad to say in my adopted country, Sweden, small-scale manufacturing is everywhere. There are lots of small factories employing maybe 20 to 100 people that make usually one thing. It's furniture. A lot of furniture is made in Sweden. But a lot of engineering parts, and factories exist in small towns, and those factories give employments to people. And by being more self-sufficient as a country, those individuals are able to be more self-sufficient too. So it's very important that if we are going to try and be self-sufficient, as part of our move towards simplicity, that we should be expecting our countries to be the same thing, to be self-sufficient. How can we do that? Well, two things you can do. One is, if you're buying things, make sure that you're buying locally. Make sure that if you can, and I know this isn't always possible, especially living in a remote rural area, but if you can, buy things locally. Ask where things were made. See if they were made locally. If you live in the US, buy things that were made in the US. If you live in the EU, buy things that were made in the EU. If you live in Australia, buy things that are made in Australia. You get the idea. I don't need to go on. Try and buy things that are made local. Never buy things that are not produced on your continent. If you live in North America or Europe and you want a new kitchen built, build it out of European wood that was grown very close to where you live. Don't buy wood that comes all the way from South America or that comes from Africa, because in doing so, you're destroying rainforests. You're not helping anybody. African wood is fine for African people to buy. European wood for European people to buy. If there's not enough wood in your country, start some more forests now. Encourage people to. It's election year almost everywhere in the world. We've had some big ones already. There's more to come. If politicians knock on your door, this isn't to push any political party, because I'm not going to do that, but ask the people asking for your vote, ask them what they think about homegrown food, what they think about supporting farmers, what they think about supporting small family farms, what they do to protect and encourage small-scale manufacturing industry. What are they going to do to reduce imports? What are they going to do to ensure that your country is as self-sufficient as possible? These are the questions you have to ask them. So when electioneers knock on your door, that's what to tell them, please. And use your vote to encourage those things you believe in. Now, how is my year going in the spring here? So far, so good. There has been some badger activity. Long-term listeners will know that badgers trashed my crop growing last year. They absolutely decimated it, and I had to start over again. That was because of droughts and because the supply of worms in the woods was running short, so they came to find them in my garden. There have, I'm afraid, been some badgers in the garden this year already causing issues. They dug up all the peas I'd sown, and they'd messed up a few plots that I got ready for sowing. But I think it's going to be better this year, because there is a bit more rain and a bit more rain forecast. So I'm hoping that we have no drought this year. I will touch wood in that that's going to be the case. Where you are, what you're growing is important. Now, to some of you, it's autumn. You're harvesting, you're processing, you're canning, you're pickling, you're storing. Good luck with that. I hope it all goes well. To other people in the Northern Hemisphere, it's spring. Get out there and do something. Get out there and sow. If you've got a bit of land with nothing sown on it, you could be producing food on that. If you don't want to produce your food, get some flower seeds. Look for big open flowers that pollinators like to visit and plant them. Why not, if you haven't got a tree in your garden, get one. An apple tree is good. All kinds of fruit trees are good, but if you don't want to grow a fruit tree, grow a hazel. All those nuts, all those leaves, all those lovely hazel twigs that you can do all kinds of things with. It's a wonderful tree to have. So if you have a corner of your garden, or in the middle of your lawn, if you've got a bigger garden, plant a tree. Good time of year to get a potted tree. It's too late for bare root in the north. But if you get a potted tree, you can put it in, and it will put on a lot of growth before next winter and get its roots down deep, and it will serve you for many years. Okay, thank you for listening. I hope to talk to you again soon. I'm sorry if I'm a bit slow with these podcasts. I am very busy on the homestead at this time of year, as you can imagine. If you're on social media, do encourage people to listen and tell them about it if you can. Even people that aren't going to like it, are going to be good listeners to the program. You don't have to like what I'm saying to listen. Okay, until I welcome you back here to my homestead next time, I'll say goodbye for now and thanks for coming.